Introduced to you now the first person at McGill that I saw using PowerPoint. It'll tell you something about technology. And you can see she has high-tech solutions for our medical system, our record system, our prescribing system as well. She's really, this is only one of three or four big areas that I know of that she's been working in. A couple of the others have to do with sick building syndrome. And some very fancy studies she did in Montreal looking at whether more fresh air was better for you in these sealed buildings and so on. She might get a chance to talk about that at the end if there's time. The other one she's been very big on, and where she did her PhD on, was on the measurement of clinical skills and doctors' performance. And she is an author of a very important study, I think, is it in CMAJ on the licensing exam? JAMA, Americans, okay, sorry. There's a part of an exam for getting your medical license that tests your clinical skills, not just pencil and paper exam taking, but actually on real patients with real problems. And she has a very important paper in that area, I think one of her most important, that says you people, you doctors who complain about paying $2,000 for this extra exam, believe me, it works, and it can show who needs attitude training, who needs care, and who needs watching, so that they don't have, you know, major complaints and malpractice suits against them later on, so that we can remedy it now while it's going on. So she's been involved in medical education and the performance of doctors for a long, long time, and so. I think tonight we're going to see just one of the three, but I'm hoping some other points will come up as well. So, Robin, as always, high tech, and but a very good story. So, away you go.
Thanks very much, Jim, and it's just a true privilege to be here today. So we are going to try something, a little bit of an interactive exchange here, and we do hope it will work. So each of you should have a clicker thing. Okay, so we're just going to walk through, because this is new for all of us, we're just going to walk through a question. Now, this is a little bit of a fun question. So what you need to do here, just to see if it's all working, is you need to tell us what your favorite ice cream flavor is. And so you have buttons on your clicker. So if you like chocolate the best, you press A, I think it says 1/A, so that's A. Vanilla B, strawberry C, Rocky Road D, and the best in the world, chocolate chip mint, not to influence you. So why don't we go ahead and start? And my colleague Jessica is going to help me out if I get into trouble. So, pardon?
Don't press anything.
Don't press something, okay. Okay, so what you need to do now is vote, okay? So everybody's voted? No? Okay, you got to vote. Go ahead and vote. Just to see if we can use this thing. Okay. Can I do something now? Now I do something. Okay. So now I'm going to press. Aha! Oh, look at this. Yes, indeed. It's the Christmas season. Chocolate chip mint is the winner in this crowd. Fantastic. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so what I've inserted in this talk is I've inserted issues that have become either local policy issues or I'd say national or even international policy issues, and we want to have your feedback. Now, it turns out that, It turns out that you're going to have to actually make a note of because we want to have a discussion about this afterwards, because we're going to see what our responses are, but we'll want to talk about it. So please make a note of your thinking that is the rationale for your voting on these policy issues as they come up, and then we're going to go back to them, okay? So are you ready to go? So nothing first. So I think we're in a situation right now where, thank the Lord, something is happening in terms of the digital age is finally meeting healthcare. It's not just about electronic health records or medical records. It's far, far more than that. And so I wanted to actually give you an example of how the expected benefits of technology. So the thinking here is that by using technologies that they've for a long time been using in the media business, in the banking business, in the e-commerce business, is that if we start bringing those into healthcare, here's the big hope. And maybe it was an overblown hope, but it would reduce errors. It would improve follow-up monitoring. It would improve appropriateness because we could provide decision support at the point of care. It would improve adherence to evidence-based health care, meaning we could bring evidence to the point of care when it was fresh off the press. It might even reduce cost, and it would help us maybe start monitoring what's going on in the population so that people who actually have to manage health care will know what's happening in a more timely way. So here was the big hope. And so if we look at what's happening in health care, we're in a little bit of trouble, actually. So we spend about $220 billion a year in Canada every year on health care, and we've been sort of sinking to the bottom of the international leaderboard here. So Canada is ranked fifth out of six comparison countries, with the United Kingdom right at the top. And they pulled up their socks and they did a massive renovation of their healthcare system about 20 years ago. And so if it wasn't for the United States, we'd really be at the bottom of this set of countries. And the reason, I think, is that, well, thank goodness for the United States, this is before Obamacare, by the way, is that we really haven't adapted our system to the thing that it needs to do now, which is to manage chronic conditions. That's really the state of the being right now. So it's really 1950s, you know, polio, acute problems. We're no longer in that space, really. So that's the challenge. And if we had done something about this a bit earlier, we could have saved about $659 billion if we had just even matched what the United Kingdom did. And they were in terms of major renovations in the way we deliver care. And the issue in healthcare is really, it's not about, you know, we'd save a lot of money, but it's really opportunity cost. So what could we have done with that money if we had actually acted earlier? So we could have actually provided $5 daycare for 14.6 million children. We could have given students free tuition. That seems to matter here in this province a lot. So we could have done that. Or we could have built over 9,000 Trans-Canada highways. So there is an opportunity cost here when we don't act, and so we really do need to act. And I think the digitization of healthcare gives us new tools that will allow us to do things that we could maybe not do as well as we had. So let's just take a look at some of the challenges. And I just want to walk you through a case, and this is a 77-year-old woman, Madame Blanc, and she has diabetes, and she has heart problems, and she has arthritis. And it was the weekend, and she developed what she thought was a urinary tract infection, which she had recurrently through her youth. And there was no one around, so she went to a walk-in clinic, and she got a prescription for an antibiotic. And then the next week, she went off to see her cardiologist because he was looking after all of her heart problems. And she received from her local pharmacist all of her drugs, basically, a different pharmacist, for her diabetes and her cardiac problems and so on. And then she went off to see a rheumatologist. She'd waited about a year to see him, and she finally saw him and for hip problems, her arthritis, and he gave her a prescription for Vioxx, and she filled that at his clinic pharmacy. And the problem with that drug was that, in fact, it was not known at that point, but, in fact, that drug had to be withdrawn from the market sometime later because it produced an excess of heart attacks, effectively, and strokes. So that was not known at that time, but here she had that dispensed. And so let's look at the problems. First, drugs are approved, and there's no way of following those drugs up once they get into the real world. To determine if they cause adverse effects. And I know Dr. Suisa came by a little while back, and in fact we are at the brink of actually being able to do things quite differently in this field, and that's what I want to cover today. So that's one issue. And the second issue is that in this day and age, we are faced with the fact that people do need and often use multiple physicians who prescribe therapy and treatment for them, and they often will use multiple pharmacies. So that creates a challenge in terms of communication and information exchange. So she went on, and there was a lot of pills that she was taking, about eight bottles, and they wouldn't fit in her purse, so she put all the pills in one bottle so they get in there. And what was unknown about that is that now we've got a bunch of drugs where, in fact, they're from different prescribers, different pharmacies, and there was actually a contraindication with the antibiotic that she got with her other medications, and it produces essentially bleeding as the risk of that particular problem. And so there was no one checking those contraindications because no one had all that information. So that was a bit of the challenge. So anyway, unfortunately, she was in the unlucky state, and she actually had a stroke as a result of that. And she went off and was deposited at the emergency department, and they called the pharmacist, who said, I don't really know about those other drugs because I only dispensed the Vioxx. So because all those pills were in the new bottle, her Vioxx bottle. So then she went on. She developed seizures as a result of her stroke, and so she went to see a neurologist in the hospital who actually prescribed an anticonvulsant for her. On discharge, she took it to the community pharmacist to fill it, and the community pharmacist couldn't read it. In fact, that prescription was pretty illegible. And as a result, she ended up by dispensing twice the dose that was actually prescribed. And so Madame Long became dizzy, and she fell down and broke her hip. So she was hospitalized again for surgery and rehab. And in the hospital, the pharmacist didn't get a complete list of all the medications she was on. And so the physician didn't know she was on an anticoagulant. And as a result, she didn't prescribe it. And as a result, Madame Blanc had a stroke. So the big problem here is there was no proper what we call medication reconciliation done, meaning what drugs were you on in the community so I make sure that you're on them in the hospital. So with that sad story, let's look at what we could do and what is possible. And so the first issue is, what about this issue of tracking drugs after they're approved and they're put into the marketplace? What are the possibilities with respect to pharmacosurveillance? So one thing that's just happened, and maybe some of you know that, is that there was a law passed called Vanessa's Law. And it was a fellow who was a member of parliament. His daughter died of a adverse drug effect for a drug. She was given cisapride, actually, for weight loss. In effect, it wasn't even approved for that indication. And so he wanted to have drugs, a mandatory monitoring of drugs. And so this resulted in sort of a massive upgrade of the federal regulations with respect to these drugs, so that, in fact, there was now the policy and legal framework for drugs to be monitored more effectively. And what we know is that spontaneous reports from physicians about adverse drug events are probably one-thousandth of all of the adverse events that happen. And so there's some very interesting things that are happening with respect to the use of the digital opportunities to look at data. And they represent essentially both electronic health records and the social media and so on. And if we look at that, this is a really fascinating work that was done, some of it by Canadians, in fact, where they're actually trying to mine effectively the Twitter and social networks to identify essentially individuals who are complaining about influenza. And this is a way of trying to actually identify early on what's happening so that there can be proper public health action taken. And so what they noted with that is that if they start monitoring the tweets and the texts and the SMS messages on cell phones, that in fact they can pick up before, essentially the red line is the way you would normally pick it up, so you can see these big hills are picking up effectively influenza much earlier by using this kind of data. And this is the Canadian researcher who we wanted to recruit to McGill. We're still working on that, who actually grew up in Montreal, and he worked with Google to actually figure out a system of mining that social network data. And he showed, actually, in a New England Journal article that it picked up, effectively, that Mexican outbreak of H1N1 2 weeks earlier than the Center for Disease Control in the United States. So this is an opportunity for real power in terms of actually earlier detection of things in the population, so we don't have to wait for the 560th death from cisapride that Vanessa's Law instigated, that we can actually try to detect these things earlier. So what about in prescribing? I mean, can you actually have a way of picking this up for adverse drug events earlier in the course? And one opportunity that we tried to create, or we did create, actually, I should not have tried, but was to say, can we start capturing the reasons why people stop drugs and why they prescribe them, so that we can actually start monitoring who's getting what drugs and for what, and especially if it's off-label, we don't know even if it's going to work for that situation, it may be unsafe. And then when drugs are changed and stopped, why are they changed? So you can see that at the top of this list is they're stopped or changed for adverse drug effects or allergic responses or for drug interactions and so on. So you can see that there is an opportunity here in sort of technologies that we've developed here locally at McGill for actually trying to actually change it so that we can actually have earlier information collectively, not just even in Quebec or Canada, but around the world. So the question I have for you, here's your first question, is should we be able to use anonymized, this is de-identified, so there's no person identified, data from these electronic health records to measure the risk and benefits of drugs after they're approved? So here we go. You've got your clicker out. You can click A for yes and B for no. There's another question coming up after this, and I want you to make note of your issues and concerns around this so that we can have a good discussion afterwards. So has everybody voted? Everybody's voted. I'm afraid to go to the next step. Okay, so 90%, 97% said yes, 3% no. And so we do want to hear from the no's in this regard because we really want to know what the precautions are that you would want to put in place should you, this become something that we end up by trying to do. So the next question I have for you is should you have to give explicit consent to have your anonymized data used for the purposes of monitoring the risk and benefits of drugs? Okay, so A is yes, B is no. Now, someone put a cute question in here. What happens if you're delirious? I presume that you will not be voting yes or no at this point. This is not you in the audience being delirious. It's if you are delirious and you've arrived unconscious, then should that data be used is really the question. So anyway, back to your voting. Vote yes, A is A, and no is B. So you ready? Okay. Very interesting. Okay, so make notes. We want to have a little discussion at each point, but it turns out that we can't do that right away. So make notes about this, these two questions, because this is worthy of a little bit longer discussion for sure. Okay, so next problem that we're trying to tackle is there's no sharing, there's no monitoring, and no follow-up of medication effects, at least not in a systematic way. For individuals, for the population, we talked about the population, now let's talk about individuals. So this was one of the earliest studies we did here in Quebec, and we asked the question of what happens when you have multiple prescribing physicians. And so you can look at, on the left side is this bar graph that says how many, what proportion of people have at least one contraindicated drug combination as a function of the number of prescribing physicians. So if you have one prescribing physician, your chances of having some sort of contraindicated combination is about 20%. If you have more than nine prescribing physicians, you for 100% sure have at least one problem, 100%. And if you look at how many people in Quebec at that time we did this study, which was 1993, had more than nine prescribing physicians, it was 6%. So it wasn't a trivial number. And you can see very few people, 22%, had one prescribing physician. Okay, so to solve that problem, we wanted to actually provide primary care physicians at the point of care information about what drugs other people were prescribing. And so what we did is we worked on a partnership with the Régie de l'assurance maladie de Quebec, who actually pays all the pharmacists in Quebec, all the pharmacies. And we said to them, you have real-time information on this, on what drugs are dispensed. And if people consent to their primary care physician, can we build a bridge between your computers and our computers, or their computers, to actually give them information on what drugs this person is on? And so they agreed. It was something like 250 car trips to Quebec City to get them to agree, but they agreed. And so what we did is we built this kind of software so that we could actually show to primary care physicians, and here's an example of a person on three drugs. And so this is how it worked, is that this information, so they prescribed through the system, and they could see what we call the drug profile through the system of what people are on. And so the gray bar indicated that this drug was prescribed, but it was never dispensed. So it was someone who decided that they weren't going to pick up the prescription. The blue bar is that's a drug I prescribed and was dispensed, and the red bar was that this is prescribed by somebody else and is dispensed. So it actually helped differentiate who's prescribing to whom. I got to say some physicians are quite discouraged. The first time we did this was over a decade ago. as they said, you know, all the drugs I prescribe, that my patients don't pick up. They just pick up drugs prescribed by other people. They felt quite deflated about that. So it actually inures other unintended effects, demoralization of the physician workforce. So that was one mechanism of trying to do that. The second was trying to identify and what I'd say ameliorate adverse drug events as they were happening. So this was a study published in the England Journal that basically said when patients come to their doctor with a visit, two-thirds of them, when they talk about problems that are drug-related, they're kind of ignored. And in fact, no changes are made in their medication regimen. And a third of people actually don't even volunteer that information. They make decisions on their own. They reduce the dose, they stop the drug, they just live with it. And so that means that there are preventable, potentially preventable adverse drug events that are not being attended to. And could we do this better and smarter? And so we went and said, okay, well, let's build, we worked with the Ottawa Hospital team and said, let's build something that will allow us to detect earlier in the course of treatment, and new treatment is where most people have problems right as they're starting drugs, not if they've been on them for 10 years. So we'll work on those people as the highest risk populations. So they're starting new drugs. And so when a person started a new drug, we asked their physician if they wanted to be enrolled in this follow-up program. And IVRS here stands for Interactive Voice Recording System. So if the physician enrolled their patient in this follow-up program, what would happen is a computer, which is the IVRS system, would call the person at home. And they would ask how they were doing. They got a new drug. Dr. So-and-so's office asked us to call. So this way, Dr. So-and-so's office actually doesn't have to put their secretary full-time on this calling back business. So the computer calls and then asks them how they're doing. And if they're having trouble, is what they do is they ask to see a pharmacist or to talk to a pharmacist, is it will email the pharmacist, who in turn will look at the record, call the person, and then fill in a report, which goes back to the physician on their dashboard to say, this is the new drug that was prescribed, this is an antidepressant, and this person is having trembling and shaking, is having trouble with this medication, and the physician can actually look at the full report and get the pharmacist's recommendations on what to do. So here's an example of trying to use technology to bring the problems people are having to the right person at the right moment in time. So it's really trying to use technology as a triage system for getting the best out of our humans. Turns out this pharmacist loved this stuff. She went on holiday to Germany. She managed all of this from Germany. And in fact, all of the IVRS system was in Ottawa. So you can actually span huge geographic places. So you could actually provide services to people in British Columbia, for goodness sakes, or Japan or whatever else. So it provides, I'd say, health without borders kind of approach. So there is an opportunity here in Canada, and I think this is one of the issues that has been challenging for the nation, is a federal agency that was formed in the year 2000 called Canada Health Infoway, in fact, was funded each of the provinces to create a drug repository where all the prescriptions could be stored and all of the drugs that were dispensed could be stored. In Quebec, we call this the Dossier Santé Quebec. And so this was built. BC had it since 1996, actually. And so it was used to make sure that when you're prescribing or dispensing, more dispensing, actually, is that you can look to see whether there are other drugs that are on board that would potentially be contraindicate the drug you're about to dispense. But one of the issues is who should have access to this information. And this has been terribly troubling across the nation. This is a big national policy issue. So it's nice to build the technology, but the next question is, okay, who should have access? So in this province, the people who have access are approved physicians, approved pharmacists, not you, not your family. In Alberta, it's A through D. In BC, it's A and B. So I want to know your opinion as to who should have access. So, Jess, I think you only have to vote for one option, right? Or can you vote for multiple? One. Oh, too bad. Okay. Okay, so here's the question to you. Who should have access to this information? And I think what you should do is to say for certain, if you don't want to pick all of the above, for certain I want to have these people have access to this information about me. So it's either my physicians, my pharmacists, myself, my family, or all of the above. You ready to vote? Unfortunately. Yeah, we're new at this, unfortunately. So sorry, but there wasn't those other, you can vote for multiple, but I'm sorry, we're just going to have to pick one. Okay, get ready to vote. Are you done? Okay. Oh, interesting. The family's not favored here. Okay, so thank you. Please take a note, because what we're going to do is we're going to come back to the questions that really resonate. You really want to talk about them, and there's clearly some differences of opinion here. Sorry about the way we set up this voting, but onward. Okay, this one's an easy one, the illegible prescription problem. Florida in 1995 declared that it was illegal to write a handwritten prescription. That's nowhere else has that ever been done. So here's the opportunities for computerized prescribing, which means that you could have a legible prescription. And if we take a look at the legibility of drugs that are recorded in the charts, this is at the MUHC, by the way, study done in the last couple of years. So 3.9%, you can't read the drug name. 4.3%, so that's about 8% altogether. Yeah, I'm sure what drug it is because it's hard to read. Almost half of them, you can't read the strength of the format. It's not legible. So there are challenges in people's handwriting. And when this is a Dutch researcher who actually compared handwritten to computerized prescriptions, and in 16 out of the 18 studies, it showed that the errors that were made in transcribing that prescription to result in a dispensed drug were reduced by computerizing prescribing. And ourselves, we actually thought this is a way of actually, by providing structured data, people aren't prescribing things that don't exist, number one. And number two, they're prescribing things where they're picking the format and you're standardizing this so people can't make errors. So this is a thing that we developed here quite a number of years ago that's been used for the last 10 or so years for over 150,000 patients. So the question is, and this is kind of an easy one, should type prescriptions be mandatory? I mean, should there be a law passed about that? To make it mandatory that we have type prescriptions, like Florida did in 1995. Okay, everybody voting? Are you ready? Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay, so not a good enough sales job on this one, that's for sure. Okay, so let's move on. Last problem that this poor woman had was this issue of medication reconciliation. This is probably a brand new word for you. It's a struggle just getting your head around the second part of the word. But basically it's typically when people go in and out of hospital that this becomes a problem, is that the first challenge is what drugs are you on in the community? That's challenge number one. And then challenge number two is to say, okay, here are the drugs that were prescribed in the hospital, here are the ones in the community. We want to basically reconcile that. So if we've left out drugs, like we're left out for that particular woman, we want to make sure they're prescribed. And if they had stopped drugs in the community, we want to know about this, so we're not re-prescribing them now. And the third piece is, can we communicate any changes that were made during the hospital stay back out to the treatment team in the community pharmacists and physicians. Okay, so we again, another study at the MUHC, this time done in the last 2 years. And so the first question is, how many different prescribing physicians are there for a person at the time they arrive for an emergency department visit? So a third people have one physician. Do you see the same similar numbers? 20% have four or more. 47% have two to three. Most people have a single pharmacy, 80%. But 20% have more than one. And a mere 2% have four or more pharmacies that they go to on a regular basis. So what challenges are present? So we looked at discrepancies between what drugs the person was actually taking and what was documented in the chart. So the good news about this is that for things like, you know, creams and stuff like that, there may be a lot of them, 80% of them actually weren't recorded in the chart. But when it came to the very important stuff, like cardiovascular drugs and the anticoagulants, which really are important, is that there were fewer discrepancies there between what was known about what was in the community and versus what was in the chart. But still, 20% of people who were taking anticoagulants, it was not noted in the chart. So that's 20%. That's pretty big still. Okay. So, and in fact, we looked at Boston. Boston, they've been doing a lot of work in this area. They're finding a similar issue. So about half of these discrepancies are unintended, meaning no one intends to do that. And number two is that about 1 in 3 in 10 have a potential to cause real harm because you've left it out, like the anticoagulants. And most of those are caused by the fact that they don't, that people don't have the ability to take an adequate history. They don't do an adequate history of what drugs are you on. And if you think about it, I know my dad, he was on, I don't know, 7 or 8 medications, and he would tell me about their color and their shape and their size and so on and so forth. And then he would try to pronounce their Latin name, and that was like usually got into a bit of a gobbledygook, and no one was understanding anybody at that point. Anyway, so when you look at the kind of effort it takes to try to find this information out, it's pretty big. So here's an example of how much time does it take in geriatrics and in internal medicine to do a medication history. So we're in the midst of all this right now, and in internal medicine, the average number of medications people take is about 20, so it's a lot. And if you look at the number, amount of time it takes to, so just reading the chart before they even get into the room is 15 minutes in internal medicine, or 16.3 minutes. Talking to the person about what they're taking, 5 minutes, that's probably not long enough. Searching external sources like the community pharmacy, 6 minutes. Reconciling those medications, almost 20 minutes. And then writing out the discharge prescription, another 20 minutes. So it takes over an hour per person to do this. And so that's a challenge because it is required that each hospital in North America does a medication reconciliation when you get admitted and discharged. You may not know that. It's a requirement for your hospital to be accredited. And in Canada, accredited equals funded. So if you don't do it, you're not funded. If you're not accredited, that is. So this has been a challenge because it's so time-intensive and there really are not the resources around. So we created a new solution, which we've called WriteRx, which is to facilitate, make it faster, make it more accurate in terms of collecting this information. So the first thing we do is we retrieve all the information from the community drug list. From initially, we're doing it from the Régie de l'assurance maladie du Québec, and we'll do it from the Dossier Santé Québec when it's ready to go. So that actually it pre-populates what you're already on, so you don't have to enter that. And now it's a matter of checking with the person, are you taking it or not, and are you taking it in the way it was prescribed. So that's issue number one. Number two was to say, let's pull the data also from the hospital pharmacy system, and let's line everything up so that, you know, this drug that's in the community and this drug that's in the hospital, you know, it's easy for the person to see it's the same drug you're prescribing. It could be in a different dose, but it's the same drug. And so that they can actually reconcile those two fairly readily. If they decide to stop a drug, that they actually were recording effectively, why is it they're stopping the drug? And you'll see why that's important. So are they stopping it for an adverse drug event, to it's no longer needed, it's ineffective treatment? And then finally, when it comes to the discharge prescription, is that we're using simple check boxes. You know, check to continue, a delta equals a change, and X equals a stop. And so then what gets produced is a discharge prescription that looks like this. Continue these drugs, stop these drugs because of the following reasons. And these medications were modified for the following reasons. And then new medications were added for the following reasons. So it actually puts it all in one page so people can actually communicate. Okay, so this is one of the local policy challenges. It is now becoming also a national challenge, which is, should hospitals forward these changes in your medication, they will clearly, people get handed this sheet, no problem, to take with them. But should the hospital be obliged or expected to send that information on to all the community pharmacists that are involved in your care and all the physicians who are involved in your care? Okay, so A is yes, B is yes only with my consent, and C is no. It's not working? Oh, you're going to refresh the page?
Yeah. Okay.
It's working now? Yeah. So it's working now? Okay. okay. Okay, more discussion points. Excellent, okay. Next question. This is another issue that we're having. Is what happens if you don't have a primary care physician? How do we manage people who get discharged? And they don't have anybody to review those new medications you got after you're discharged. You don't have anybody to refill the medications after you're discharged. So what should the hospital do? This is happening not infrequently. So the hospital takes responsibility for finding you a primary care physician. That's one option. The patient, the patient has to go back to the emergency room to see a physician and get a refill of their medication, also happening. The pharmacist should be able to give you refills on your medication, i.e. your community pharmacist should be able to give you refills. Or the hospital should set up a clinic for this purpose so that they can actually manage the person who they treated post-discharge. Okay, so you're ready? Hopefully it's working. You got to choose one. By the way, your answer is going to count. We have a meeting in 2 weeks to discuss this issue. So your input will be very useful. Look at how we have a big survey here. This is great. Okay, you ready? Okay. Ah, wow. Okay. So that's really interesting. Sunnybrook Hospital did exactly your most favorite response. They set up a clinic to manage people post-discharge. And so did another doctor's hospital. It used to be Doctor's Hospital in Toronto. Anyway, very, very interesting. Okay, so onwards. Decision support. This is the next thing. Reviews of medication. Now that you've got structured, digitized data, you can actually do this. You can have a drug knowledge module review all the medications and spit out alerts. And we partner with a firm in Quebec that actually does do that, and we've been working with them for the last 10 years to generate essentially these alerts at the time of prescribing. And so here's an example of an alert that about two medications that may mask symptoms, and so the person is advising that it should these should not be prescribed together. And one of the challenges we've had with these kinds of systems is this. So we randomized doctors into getting these only when they requested them, meaning you request a review and you get a review, or it automatically happens and we push it to you whether you want it or not. So the big issue, and this is a worldwide problem, by the way, is that for the 3,500 patients or so that were randomized as part of their doctor's randomization, is that those patients basically had about 3 to 4 alerts each. So if you do the math, the number of alerts were 4,445 for that 1,550 patients, and about the same magnitude for the automated alert group. And if you look at how many actually were looked at by the physicians, it was a pitiful, pitiful number. More in the group that got them automated, they actually saw them, and so on. But how many were actually revised? Well, only 81 out of the 6,506, and 30 out of the 4,445. So really a small number, honestly, to be revised. So this was of concern, and overrides on alerts, as they call it, is about 90%. So we need to do something, and physicians say the following. One, they override a lot. Number two, experienced physicians are more likely to override than more junior, like residents, for example. And the reason they override is they believe the benefit is greater than the risk. And so they're going to override it. Some of them they think it's just a nuisance. There's so many things here. It's not making my day. You know, what am I going to do? So we really have not dealt with this well. And so we wanted to bring science to bear on actually providing much more personalized information than this. Because this is kind of a canned program that one size fits all. So this is we felt this was one of the problems, is that we couldn't even tell them what the benefit of the risk was. So we designed something, what we call the Smart Alert System, which actually was person-specific risk assessment. So in this case, we wanted to reduce fall-related injuries. That's a big problem, especially for older people. It's related to a lot of the psychotropic drugs, they call them, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, and narcotics, and so on, that they may be taking. And so we wanted to provide this kind of an alert, a very specific alert that was centered on this person. So you can see this is Therese Lachute, very cute name, which is, of course, fall, and the risk of that person's injury. So the green zone is, you know, she's an older woman, and she has a variety of things that may increase her risk anyway. You can't do anything about that. But the red part of it was how much risk is being created just by the drug she's on and the doses with which she's on them. And you can see the red flag in that profile indicate what drugs are problematic. And so the physicians actually missed this part, which is this really ugly mathematical model, which Jim helped us design, I have to say. And it's even uglier when it gets to the drug doses. So they don't see that. They don't have to put that on their calculator to figure it out. We figure it out for them. And so then we show them essentially what happens when you prescribe something or you increase the dose of something, you're actually increasing the risk. As you can see, this particular time, Therese Lachute has many more problems and a bigger risk associated with her drugs, and now that last prescription is even added to that. So what happened when we did this? So it was really interesting. So for people who are at average risk, which they have a 3% chance, the average risk is about 3%, of having a fall-related injury that year, and this would be like a fracture or a big soft tissue injury like a sprain, is that the intervention worked, but just of marginal significance, I'd have to say. Reduced the risk, so the green bar and the purple bar, about the same. But for people who are at high risk, this is where it really worked. So really, if your risk was at 10%, meaning per year, of having a fall-related injury, is that they did address that. And they played around with this to sort of figure out what was the best combination of doing this. And in fact, this is loved so much that it will now be used as a system to support a big trial in the United States, actually. So I think this is the way to go. I think we need to provide far more personalized assessment, and computers can do that. So it's really a fun area to be in. So the question we had is this. So far, these kind of alert systems are made available to your doctor. Not all the time, sometimes. I mean, it depends on what they use. Your pharmacist typically has something like this. You don't have access to it, typically, nor do your caregivers. So our question is, who should have access to the results of these medication reviews? Do you want to know that you have 4 alerts on your medication review? So we want to hear from you. So can you vote? So only your doctor, only your pharmacist, myself and my caregivers are all the above. Sorry, we're still in the one option mode. Are you ready? Okay. Okay. All right, so this is important, and in fact, a colleague of mine collaborated to produce the Empower study, which is really giving people that information back to them. And it was highly successful. People actually acted on that. Okay, so next, case 2. How are we doing for time? 20 minutes. Okay. All right, well, we'll make it fast, okay? So case 2 is the journey of Mr. Smith. We had to make sex equity here, you know? So Mr. Smith now, he lives on his own outside the city. His children live far away. First problem, no family nearby. That's problem number 1. Number 2, he has COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, and Parkinson's disease, which makes it difficult for him to get around. Problem 2, lacks of mobility. So no one around to help him out, and he himself is lacking mobility. So one solution that people are trying out is to actually bring care closer to home. And to do this, even for fairly senior people, is to actually provide them with a tool that allows them to monitor what's going on in their health state and to communicate with their care provider through essentially what people have called patient portals. So the monitoring occurs things like this. This is pretty space age. That definitely does not look like Mr. Smith on the right, the Ralph Lauren shirt. That's not him, but it could be on him. So these smart clothing that can actually start monitoring things, this is really a happening. And here we have the smart toilet, which monitors your BMI, your blood sugar, your blood pressure, and other vital things. Okay, so we have unbelievable technology now. And that can be incorporated into things like these patient portals, which is Your Health Online, where you can actually communicate. So here's an example for his chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, where he's self-assessing where he's at, and in fact, the closer he is to the green part of the target, the better he is. And so it actually monitors his symptoms and his use of rescue medication and so on, his exercise. And his case manager can now actually monitor hundreds of patients actually using this portal to actually dialogue back and forth. People have used a variety of different things. They've used Skype. They've used this kind of a mechanism. So don't get fixated on the technology per se, but this is one methodology of allowing healthcare professionals to have more timely intervention with you on time, real time, through this kind of a mechanism. And be able to say, this is what you should be doing now in terms of your health and not doing it every 2 or 3 weeks. So this is really cool. So if we had something like this, who would you want to share your portal with? Again, we have the family, friends, physician, all of the above, no one. Assuming you're Mr. Smith. So, you ready to vote? You're going to be Mr. Smith for right now. Okay, so, are you done? Okay. So, your physician, and then all of the above is the next. Okay, family's still on the low end, and friends definitely out. Okay, great, but I know you only could vote for one. Okay, so next, blogging and texting. It's a new way of actually people starting to actually exchange, not only with people like them who have problems similar to them, but also with their care providers. This is a new service that was actually rolled out in New York City, which is online healthcare. So using your mobile phone essentially to type in your symptoms, and you have an online diagnosis by a team of online health professionals, including in this case physicians, who then send an online prescription that's called into you, so called in for you. So this is a service, and I think you'll increasingly see this kind of service being offered, maybe more so in Quebec because of the strains on the health system and the difficulty in getting access to primary care physicians and so on here. We have a fairly large private sector going on in Quebec anyway, so it may be something coming your way pretty soon. But other health systems like the Ontario Health System, in fact, they have dangerously and aggressively exploited this. I wouldn't say dangerously, I'd say creatively and exploited this to try to put telehome care in place to provide much more timely home care for people, particularly with people who have multiple conditions. They need better support than what can be provided through the home care nurse comes and visits you in your home. So this is really to bring home care to an online support system. And so what's happened with that project, they've actually gone through 600 patients, average age of 77, very similar to Mr. Smith. And in fact, what they found with that is that they've actually been able, because they can actually spread themselves thinner, cover more people, is they've been able to reduce hospitalizations and emergency department visits. So this is kind of exciting because it does mean that we can provide better care to more people in a more timely way if we start maybe adapting and adopting some of these tools. And if we look, take it to the next level, the Finnish healthcare system has just invested in the blue little thing on the right there, which is called Kangaroo, and it's a virtual presence that comes and is in your home, and the home care nurse is on that telepresence and can communicate with you and can go try to find you in your home, meaning that that thing moves around to try to find you. okay, so this is where we're going, folks. So they've invested in that as a step up, especially for people with cognitive impairment who aren't going to be able to use a computer probably. And so this is a different way of providing care. Google and Apple are all in this space, actually wanting to produce products that actually provide, in this case, it's a contact lens that will measure your blood sugar and so on. And we have now even a bionic pancreas that actually not only measures what's going on in your blood, but actually doses you up with the appropriate either insulin or glucagon, depending upon where your blood sugar is. So these are things that are happening. There's lots happening, actually. So this is just a bit of a glimpse of I think, the future. And so the question is, who should really be paying for these e-home care services? We don't in Canada have a mechanism of covering home care. It wasn't in the Canada Health Act. So we have a bit of a patchwork across the country. So your opinion counts here. This is, you know, this would be a general public next election issue in all likelihood. So who should pay for this kind of e-home care services? So over to you, A, B, or C. Are you ready to go? Okay. So, both. Okay. Interesting. Okay, fantastic. Really fantastic. So I want to thank you for your participation in this. I'm just so looking forward to your questions. We have a number of issues to cover. So we're going to collect those issues from you. This is apparently how this is done. And we're going to pull that together and have a bit of a discussion.
So the normal questions are The issue is both, I guess, and we'll sort them out when they come down here. So there's normal questions asked anyway.
Oh, okay.
And then
okay.
You've invited others as well. So put one or both, and we'll try and sort them out. I think you've given us a lot to think about. By the way, I don't think it was ever mentioned. Abe Fuchs thought that the volunteers were mainly medical students, but in fact the volunteers are all students from the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics and Occupational Health. I want to make sure that that's well known to you people. Yes, so we can start with this one. Robin, by monitoring Twitter, SMS, I don't even know how to pronounce some of these things, etc., isn't there an issue with people's privacy? What do you think? You can.
Okay. Yes, indeed, that's been the issue that's been identified, is there a framework in place, in fact, to protect the privacy of individual information? Turns out when you sign up for Facebook and you sign up for some of these things, is your information, you're signing up for your information to be used. So that, I think, is an issue. I think the regulatory environment around this, I think, has not advanced to the state to manage, I think, the digital information age. And I'd be interested in your opinion about whether or not, what kind of safeguards you would want to see put in place. Would you want to be notified when your information was being used, for example? Because it's often surprising that how much you've signed your information away, both in your banking information and so on and so forth, that information be used. I just have to say, though, that there are very advanced anonymization software that are available that go, and in fact this has been developed by both Americans and Canadians, okay, to essentially de-identify information so you cannot be re-identified. So I think that is an important piece in here. I was just at a two-day affair on a sort of e-mental health, and it's an interesting discussion because some of the social media are being used to identify people who are having challenges. And in fact, there is kind of an opt-in service that can be provided for people to reach out to your friends, mm-hmm, and to your family, yeah, if you're appearing, yeah, to have challenges. So this is an opportunity to get more timely help when you need it if you take that option, but you're opting into that kind of a situation.
Okay. Why isn't it possible? Why is it not possible for X-rays at St. Mary's or the QEHC to be read at MGH or RVH? Is this not a place to start so all doctors can have access to information in the same university medical center?
Well, it's interesting, and in fact, I think the some of you may know about the Rossi Cancer Network, where they're trying to actually put together, because cancer patients are cared for by the Jewish General Hospital, St. Mary's, the Vic, and the General. And they wanted to be able to create a complete circuit of so that your care isn't interrupted and that information flows. You don't have to retell your story every time, and you have timely access to that. It turns out that the legislation in Quebec is challenging in that regard because you have to give your permission. The permission lasts for 30 days. And so on, so that it's not automated. So their way around this, and this is my understanding, is they made all physicians attending at all hospitals, mm-hmm, and so that way the information could be shared, so no matter what hospital you're at, you could have access to that particular information. So that was their workaround for the Quebec legislation. And for us looking at this, this is an impossible situation. There needs to be legislative reform in the province actually to manage this. Because it is, when people are moving, especially, I think with the new restructuring with a governance board over their eight, I can't remember what they call them now, they're not C2SS, CISS or whatever it is, the integrated care systems, is that means that all your care, they're really trying to create an HMO around a population so that all of their care can be, you know, and information about their care can be interchanged among the provider team in all of its settings for you.
So that will get around HMO that. Is
like a health maintenance organization like Kaiser Permanente in the States or the VA or something like that. So this restructuring that's going on in the Quebec health system may facilitate this by simply creating a governing body that oversees all of the care provided by the long-term care facility, the CLSC, the GMF physicians, the hospitals, the rehab facilities, and so on. So maybe that's the way around it, rather than doing legislative reform, is maybe that way.
Okay, computer monitoring is great, but elderly people need face-to-face contact and support. How can you personalize this care?
So there is a new a terminology that's been increasingly used as something what you might call hybrid models of care. And hybrid models of care are ways of using technology to monitor, but when a human is needed, either at the request of the individual or because there's a deterioration in your state health state, is, in fact, then a human is actually alerted, and it even to the levels of alert, you know, call an ambulance, go pick that person up, like, right now, you know, that kind of approach, to give them a call on the phone or Skype them or do whatever, or just go for a regular old-fashioned home visit. So technology is being used to get the right care to the right person at the right place at the right time. And I think that's probably the best use of technology, is these what I call hybrid care models, where you're using technology to do this kind of monitoring, and then you're getting the right human to that problem in real time. So there's been some huge success stories. I think probably the most advanced country in this area is Israel, in actually creating these hybrid models of care. And they actually show dramatic reductions in both the cost of care and in mortality with this kind of an approach.
Is the role of the pharmacist being properly exploited, given his or her relative accessibility relative to physicians?
Yeah, there has been legislative reform across Canada to increase and expand the role of community pharmacists. Probably the most advanced is in Alberta, so that they can prescribe, that they can do flu vaccinations. That's a commonplace now, that flu vaccinations are done in the pharmacy, that they can stop and change medications, that they can monitor medications, such as the anticoagulants. So the scope of practice, the legislative scope of practice, has definitely increased. What hasn't changed is really the business model for how the pharmacies work. So most of their money is made by dispensing medication and then the purchases you make in the front of the store. So unless that changes, I'm not sure that you're going to see the same expanded role of the pharmacist that is now legislatively possible. We've been in that space trying to increase their role in helping people with their medication adherence, the medication review, and so on. And there's fee structures that are put in place to support this. But it really isn't on balance with the business model they currently use, which is more successful. So I think that's the barrier right now. It's not much more than that.
How accurate are the online apps deliver healthcare? Apps deliver healthcare. Doesn't that increase the risk of a wrong prescription?
Yeah, I'm not sure how many apps are in the Apple App Store right now. Someone may know. Let's try a 5,000 or 500,000, something in that neighborhood, right? So it is a bit of an app zoo right now. And so much so that various countries and groups have taken it upon themselves to set up a review process for those apps. So they can look at what's the evidence to support them, and the story is not much. So that there are people who create them, but you don't know if they work or not, and you don't know if there's misadventures as a result of it, and you don't know if there's unintended consequences or if there are true benefits being reaped. And so there are these review processes now happening in terms of the apps in the App Store, so that, in fact, a subset of apps can be supported. Because there's a lot of very fertile minds out there doing really intellectually phenomenal things. And it's almost like everybody's making an app right now, but we need some process of accreditation and of review of these apps, because they'll be out of date too soon. So we need a sort of a process for that, and I think that's been sort of recognized.
Has the internet increased cases of hypochondria? Do physicians... Do physicians lose efficiency due to these usually false cases?
That's a really interesting question. And in fact, the whole discussion around with that IVRS system I showed, you know, there are some physicians who definitely didn't want to enroll their patients because they said if you called them up and they asked them about their medication and how they're managing with that new medication, they would definitely essentially imagine symptoms they didn't have. And so they didn't want to have the extra work that it would take to actually, you've created an anxiety that you didn't need to create kind of phenomenon. It's quite interesting because when it came to opening up the full electronic medical record to patients so that they could actually look at their labs, they could look at their diagnostic imaging reports and so on, there was a lot of pushback actually. And the pushback was from the health professionals because they thought that this would create demand, it would create hypochondria, it would create unnecessary questions and they couldn't really do their job well. The reality is that it doesn't do that. It changes the dialogue. So where it started was Columbia Presbyterian, New York, Group Health, opened their electronic clinical system to patients first, actually, before the health professionals. So patients got there first. And the dialogue that changed was, you've lived with the chronic disease for 8 years, you actually start to know it better than anybody else, and you want to be able to manage it yourself. In partnership with your clinical treatment team. And so it changes the dialogue. No longer you're in for the visit to review what your lab tests showed. You've reviewed them yourself before you came to the visit. And because you had this illness, you've been managing it for 8 years. And so I think the reality of it creates the hypochondria is not the true reality. It's really empowering people to actually start managing their health a little bit better and have the information to do so. And then they can have other discussions that are more productive with their healthcare team. My take on this situation. But there is this fear. And so when Quebec actually passed the law for who has access to the Dossier Santé Quebec, the DSQ, is patients were left out. Yeah. You have to go and see your physician to have access to your own information. So, whatever.
What is preventing general practitioners from all using true electronic health records? Is there a standardized software recognized by the RAMQ or a shared platform?
The basic issue with electronic health records is that first generation that was produced was not very intelligent. It's a big bucket with data in it that isn't really helpful to people. It takes them more time. We had this series of MOXIE projects, Medical Office of the 21st Century projects. In the second stage, we actually incorporated lab reporting and so on to an electronic health record. It took physicians an average of an hour longer per day to actually enter information into this electronic medical record. So it was... And it was interesting because they didn't have to enter everything. They entered some stuff, but it had all these structured fields. And so they said, well, I guess I have to compulsively enter everything, right, even though I wouldn't have normally done that. And so it actually provided them with no value, and it had this deficit of adding time to their day. So they're not very intelligent. And so there's been reviews done of this, even recently published as of 6 months ago, about that whole generation of electronic medical records was what you might call not created with the user in mind. And so I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a new generation that is going to actually start using, you know, voice to text and natural language processing to process that information. So it makes it easier for a human, for the healthcare team to manage, and you're not putting them as, you know, typists or whatever, data entry clerks into an electronic repository.
What are the real world evidence-based benefits and drawbacks seen from using EMRs, electronic medical records? In other words, have we got good evidence of benefits and drawbacks? Are we there yet?
I'd say there's worldwide consensus at this point that the science is pretty thin, meaning that there isn't much that is really known about it. Did you get the benefit you expected to? Is there a return on investment from digitizing healthcare? It's not to say that there isn't a benefit, but it's just to say the science really hasn't been done. The question really hasn't been evaluated. Some of the things that and it's only now starting to come out of the U.S. in terms of the repositories. So meaning like the repositories that created Quebec. If you put all the labs in a repository, people don't have to repeat the lab test over and over again, da-da-da-da-da. You know, your digital images don't have to repeat it again, your x-rays and so on. And It's not coming out as rosy as people expected to. There wasn't necessarily a reduction in lab test ordering that for duplicate tests because you couldn't get access to the result, and the same for digital imaging. So it's early days yet, I'd have to say. It revolutionized other industries, for sure. It was a point of failure or a point of great success. So we've learned a lot from the business school here at McGill, actually, about what worked, what didn't. But it really has been for the investment, the magnitude of the investment made in the UK, in all of the European countries, we really have very limited information on how well did that work and was it, you know, what were the lessons learned, how could we have been more cost effective in what we did. So it's kind of a sad state of affairs that the science has really not been adequately funded and adequately conducted.
Okay. Are pharmacies in the same group, for example, Pharmacry or Jean Couture, are they able to communicate with each other, ones in the same group?
That's really interesting. So times have changed. It used to be that you had software on each computer, and then the computers couldn't talk to each other. If the computer was lost, that was the end of that. You know, you lost everything. So now people actually they have databases central and they have kind of a web-based application in front of you. So the data is always kept, it's supported, and that's a far safer situation to be in. So Jean Coutu, for example, has a central database. It has, so all the Jean Coutus, they have a database. And the what's in the store is essentially the web interface to that database. For Pharmapre, I'm not sure where exactly they got to this point. They used to be the one where there's a computer on the desktop and all the data's on that desktop, and it can't be shared with anybody else. So it was interesting because even when you have two Jean Coutus, where the data is possible to share, is they are competitors with each other, actually. So they are, you go to one Jean Coutu, they're going to make a lot more money than the other Jean Coutu, so... There was a business reason for not sharing. There was that issue. So Jean Coutu basically, I think, provided leadership in this area, and they said, well, let's ask people, you know, whether they want to have their information shared. And so they asked people, and they discovered that about 20% of people didn't want to have their information shared. Those 20% was 80% on Nuns Island, and about, you know, 5% everywhere else. So I know what's going on in Nuns Island. But on Nuns Island... Most of in Montreal, the information non-sharing came from. So it is possible, but there are, it's just like sharing information from one hospital to the next. They need to have your consent to do so. And if you don't provide your consent, then that information doesn't get shared. And we have a kind of a pony, donkey, snail mail system to make that happen. So by the time your consent gets to the hospital, de rigueur, the 30 days has expired. That's it. So you have to go get another consent. It's ridiculous, actually. It's just ridiculous.
Is there a correlation between the number of drugs a patient takes and the risk of mortality, even if there is no contraindication?
There's been a lot of work done in this area. So age and the number of medications are highly correlated. So the issue is it really the number of medications you're on, or is it your age? In fact, one of the guys who's actually tackled that is Dr. Teddy Agwali here in this room. And so the answer to that question is, yes, as you get older, you're more likely to have more drugs. The more drugs you're on, the more likely you're going to have some kind of issue related to those drugs because no one does testing on people who are on 20 drugs, I can assure you. You know, no drug trials run on people on 20 drugs. So you don't know, actually. And this is with the whole point of needing real-world post-market surveillance to help us understand how drugs are working in the population in which they were never tested. So the answer to the question is more likely that it's more drugs that matters than your age.
Okay. Two questions related to sort of access. One, how do we prevent people living in remote areas with limited cell phone internet service from being shut out of digital? I guess they're saying, aren't people in remote areas being shut out of the digital world?
Yeah.
And secondly, as an 80-year-old, how do we get plugged into the system in Quebec? I imagine they're the same thing, age and remoteness, both.
A couple of places, provinces that have actually had remote issues is really a big issue for them. Newfoundland's one. New Brunswick is another one. Northwest Territories is another one. Is they've invested heavily in the internet infrastructure, so that, in fact, people are all connected. And that's, you know, it has many, many advantages for both social programs, for educational programs, for health programs. So it is a bit of a policy issue as to whether or not you're going to subsidize that investment or are you going to partner with companies to make it happen. I think in the north, for sure, I think the mining explosion in the north is going to need a digital infrastructure, and health will benefit from the kind of investment made by industry in that area. Ditto for northern Quebec, in all likelihood. But I do think that this is a public policy issue that needs to be addressed, particularly if we want to reap the benefits, I think, of some of the opportunities with telehome care. I think that's a big winner, to be honest. I think that we should move on that one, including providing people with digital access in their home. And in fact, when it came to, I think the VA studies, high complex users in the U.S., is the group who basically manages that group gave them all mobile phones or tablets. So they are connected. It was cheaper than managing any other way.
Yeah. And the 80-year-olds, the same thing, I guess, for age and the internet.
Age and the internet. Yeah, well, the fastest growing sector using internet are people over the age of 65. Yeah. So.
Is it because it's no longer computers, it's tablets? Is that the reason?
It's kind of all of the above, mobile technologies and computers. And for those who can't, of course, there's always the kangaroo, you know, that blue thing, that will follow you around and talk to you.
Given that prescription drugs have different effects on different ages and genders, does the analysis of adverse effects take these differentiations into account?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And one of the initiatives that we have underway is what we call an international pharmacosurveillance system that we're trying to build out of this digitization of healthcare so that we actually can extract. So if you had, let's say, 56 countries in the world monitoring in real time using point-of-care systems like I showed you, how drugs are working, is that you could start drilling down because you'd have the numbers. You know, the issue is time and numbers, right? So you have 56 countries versus one country of 33 million. So 56 countries, you're actually monitoring 5 million people a day who are actually on a new drug that's just came into the market, as opposed to 25 in the province of Quebec. So that gives you the opportunity of sort of saying, well, what about if you're old and what about if you're young? Because these are all subgroups to make the number smaller. So what if you're old, what if you're young, what if you're Asian, what if you're black? Male versus female, females and males metabolize drugs differently sometimes for some drugs, is that it allows you to sort of drill down. So I think the challenge is, can we create an international surveillance system that we can bring the numbers up so that we can start looking at the subgroups, the impacts in the subgroups? Because I think that's important, whether it's kids or people who have particular genomic phenotypes, you know.
I'm watching the clock, and I know you want to get to the issues you raised yourself specifically. So how do you want to handle it? Do you want to go back and revisit some of those?
I think I'd be interested, actually, in picking up on two issues. And I wonder if the group, I guess what I can do is if you raise a question, I can repeat the question. I'm not sure if that's allowed.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that. So I'd love to know about this issue of sharing information and what are the circumstances where that would be appropriate, both in terms of clinical care sharing with the care team in the community, sharing information for monitoring safety and effectiveness of medications and devices and all sorts of things. So I'd be very interested in your thoughts about that, as to what are the things that would worry you and what are the conditions that would actually alleviate your worries.
Anyone want to start? And we can repeat the question from here if we get it.
Obviously, privacy is huge. Privacy is huge. And with all the hacking that goes on, and the money behind the insurance companies, who's to say the insurance companies aren't going to hack into your systems to get information on, you know, the people that are insured?
Can everyone hear what she said, or should I repeat it?
You repeat it.
I repeat it. So you said, first thing is privacy is a big issue. And hacking into your privacy, and you're particularly interested in insurance companies?
Our governments,
yeah. So,
Snowden,
okay, yeah. Okay, so is that enough to...
Yeah, so I'd, I think that is the counterbalance, effectively. So if you don't have access to this information in a much more real-time way, you won't know the answer. And yet, I guess I'm of the belief that we could have a regulatory framework, and I think there's been an effort to try to do this in the U.S. through the HIPAA legislation, to say you are jailed for using information that you don't have the right to. And that's the HIPAA legislation in the United States. So if we had the right regulatory framework and the right safeguards, and particularly if you were notified, for example, when your information was being used, then that would empower you to control what's happening, it would seem to me. So can we create the right framework for making this happen so we can reap the benefits without the harms of privacy breaches that would be potentially problematic, if not lethal for individuals?
The problem is getting the privacy in place before.
She's asking, how can we get the privacy in place before you then give your information? Or guarantee it.
Mm-hmm.
He says he doesn't trust the government any more than the insurance companies.
Sorry.
So you hear what she's saying? She's saying privacy is getting trumped by actually the need for other people to know, and that information shouldn't get lost. And you think that's a bigger imperative than...
Well, I think it is in many cases.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there other question? Other issues? Oh, yes. This man wrote this question. I'll read it out again then. Prospect for a national patient medical information and existing diseases database, is that it? Or you mean a common one across provinces? And also National Association of Provincial Medical Associations sponsorship and promotion. I'm not sure where that fits in. But
of that.
Okay. A national, basically a national system, right? He's a lawyer, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, that was the stated goal of Health InfoWave, was to create the capacity to move information across provinces. So if you became sick in Vancouver, the people in Vancouver could find out what was happening in Montreal. It turns out that it's far more challenging to move information around locally, and that's the biggest challenge. The biggest proportion of people have the biggest problem getting timely access to information they need to care for people. And so, because most care is delivered locally, and it isn't the most common situation to have people traveling across provinces where they actually essentially have to have that information. So there was a national architecture put in place. There was something that was mimicked by other countries. But the reality is that it just hasn't come to pass. And it's been challenging enough just to get these repositories in place provincially, and then to work out the regulatory environment to support that, and who's going to pay for maintaining them, that's another issue. And then who has access to them, that's another issue. And is the effort to get access to them, meaning I have to remember a password that changes every 20 minutes and it's 89 characters long and so on and so forth, is that, you know, that in itself is a challenge. And so, I would aspire at least to hopefully try to create local exchanges of information in a timely way at the point of care where you need to have it first, and then let people put their information on CD-ROMs or have access to a patient portal for themselves that they could provide a a password to, so that if they're out in British Columbia, then they can say, look at my patient portal with all my stuff in it.
Why can't people just carry their own standardized information? You mean on a USB stick or something?
Yes, like that. If you have a USB stick with a standard form where you can fill in all your information and plug it into whichever doctor you're seeing or whichever hospital you're going to.
Yeah, so why are people carrying their own CD-ROMs, their own memory sticks around with their own information? It's really interesting. Quebec, along with other countries, actually tried something called the Smart Card Project. And I don't know if you remember that. It was tried out in Rimouski. It was a little disc on a card, and it had all your information in it, right?
Like the chip on your card.
Like the chip on your whatever, on your card. And they tried that out, and you have to have card readers and card writers. That's number one. So, you know, to read and write information. And then the next thing was, well, the chip wasn't big enough on the card. It didn't hold enough memory in it. Now, things have changed, of course. That should no longer be an issue. But it was the reading and writing time and the fact that you lost your cards, therefore you had to have a backup of the card. So then maybe we should use the card as the access point into that information. Yeah. To be honest, when you look at that, I think for the average person who has a couple of things wrong with them, I think that's fine. For the people that we're now working with in the Medication Reconciliation Project, they're on 20 medications, a third of them get changed. You know, they have whatever, the volume of their charts is like yay thick. I mean, it's sort of hard to know. You need a subset of the information that's dynamically changing through time. So there are some real challenges with the most fragile people, which is really where you need to have that information. So it is a solution, but not for the people who are the, I'd say, main users of healthcare.
There were two questions, sort of futuristic. Where do you see, what do you see as the future of healthcare in terms of technology? And are all these measures actually ones that can be implemented in the near future? Because you gave us some really high-tech ones there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the future, in the next 10 years, what do you see coming?
I think this is just my crystal ball gazing. What I think is going to happen, at $220 billion a year, it's not sustainable. We can't continue to grow it at 5% per year. It's just not sustainable. So I think one of several possibilities will probably happen. One is that you'll start to see a growing private sector in healthcare, and you'll start seeing a two-tiered system, and I think that's the big worry. The UK went through that, and they fundamentally addressed it by actually beefing up and making promises and charters to the public and actually bringing their system back on board, and you could see what happened as a result of that. So I do think that's the fear that will happen, is that the two-tier system will develop. The other thing which I think is quite interesting, which could happen, especially in resource imbalanced areas where you have a whole bunch of people in Toronto and no one in Northern Ontario, for example, is that you'll see healthcare cross boundaries, cross borders, and you'll start having professionals who will be working. You'll be working with someone who basically is a BC home care nurse who's going to help you in Quebec, for example, because that person happens to speak whatever Mandarin, and we don't have enough people here who speak Mandarin. And so I think that's what we'll start to see. And technology will enable that. It will enable the workforce to do the thing that it does very well, which is highly educated people trained to care for you and not people who are trained to actually, you know, essentially continuously write the same medication list over and over again, which is what we see in the hospital. So we actually see that technology could actually empower people to do their job better. And as a result of empowering them to do their job better, is that we could start using essentially technology to bring them to the right person at the right point of care at the right time in the right setting. And we can start to break down the barriers of siloed people in different environments and start using them essentially to serve the population. Now, we have health as a provincial jurisdiction, so I'm not sure that you will see that happen rapidly. But provinces are making arrangements, and they have made arrangements for specialized services, to say we don't have to do everything here. You know, we can contract for additional specialized services, which would be great, especially if you have a rare disease, right? you had a rare disease, you want to be looked after by the specialty clinic that looks after those kind of rare diseases. And I think this would be low-hanging fruit to go after some of those things in terms of actually giving people the best that they can get in the trained workforce and actually capitalize on that, you know, creating a cross-border kind of, healthcare workforce environment. So I see that being the good side. I think that's really very positive things that can happen. And on the downside, I see this two-tiered system, and the private sector will definitely pick this up, and they will definitely run with it because it's a far easier and better way of providing health care than what we're doing right now.
Other questions? One reminder first.
Sorry, that was a little bit of a rant. But
yeah. One reminder, I've told you already that you have to sign back your picker with somebody or they will be after you with the bill collectors. And second, just to wrap up, we started way back 150 years ago and 200 years ago, and 50 years ago last week with epidemics, but it's very nice to be comforted and see Robin, who was ahead of the curve with PowerPoint, and she's still ahead of the curve, and to give you this fantastic description of what's ahead of us in the next 10 years. So thank you again, Robin.
Thank you. That's a good question, Dave.
Yeah.